And we'll, but there is a disclaimer here, not a disclaimer, but so you don't sue us and, oh yeah.
Yeah, you gotta worry about that.
Yeah, it says we'll be sending copies of this to Cooperstown Hall of Fame. And so I'm gonna get you in the Hall of Fame, Bob. And just as Sabre reserves the right to distribute this tape to other researchers, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I got a book that's gonna come out in about probably August or September.
Oh.
I'll tell you the name of it, but I'll tell you, give you an idea, but don't put this in your article, okay?
Yeah, I'll turn it off here for a second. Where do I do that? I do that right. Okay.
You know, I was with Yogi over at the fantasy camp, and I went up to Yogi, make sure it turned on.
It's working.
And I said to Yogi, you did that commercial with that duck. I said, what, did the duck really speak? He said, I never even saw it. No. But he did his scenes away from the duck.
Yeah.
And I said, Yogi, you and I have known each other a long, long time. We locked together for 8 years. And I said, but Yogi, I don't remember you saying all the things you're getting credit for.
Yeah.
He said, well, I said them. And I said, well, Yogi, let me tell you one. You said the one, if you're driving down a road and you see the fork, take it. I said, Yogi, that means a lot of different things. He says, it means you take the fork, either road goes to my house. I didn't even take a fork. That's how it came out.
Well, I told you I wasn't going to ask you about all the guys you played, because, you know, everybody's done that. But I was going to ask you that. Did Yogi really say all that
stuff? Yeah, he said, and then I said, Yogi, and the other one, I can't believe you said, because I just don't remember this, Yogi. And, and it's the other one, he says, well, people don't go to that restaurant anymore.
Yeah.
And Yogi says, they said, well, why, Yogi? He says, it's too crowded.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
I said, you didn't say that. He said, I sure did.
Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's claiming credit for stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's made some money.
He's doing real well now. That duck commercial is probably one of the top ones out right
now. Is that right?
Yeah. But he's a hell of a nice
guy. Well, he just, from what I've seen in biographies, he just seems like a nice man.
He really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching on television the other day. He was played in the Bob Hope Celebrity Car out there. I said, well, I can't get a hold of him. I know he ain't back home now.
Yeah.
But I'll get a hold of him. We've been friends a long time ago. Yeah.
Well, you know, you play with some interesting guys. And, you know, another one, and maybe you get asked to death about this too, that I just thought about the other day is you know, the Roger Maris thing in 61, what they say he went through hell at the end.
First of all, people got to know Roger. Roger was always a very quiet guy. He wasn't a flamboyant type of guy. He didn't run around.
He wasn't Mickey.
No, he wasn't Mickey Mantle. He was an entirely different, hell of a ball, one of the best ball players I've ever watched. Great right fielder, throw good, run good, hit good, could do it all.
To have him behind you.
Yeah. And he was a great part of the team, and he was a great ball player. But Roger was the type of guy that he, dry sense of humor. Sometimes he would say something before, never intend to hurt anybody, but he would say something, and it would always come out the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember.
Some people can do that.
No, it's true. You know, Mickey could get away with a lot of that.
Because he had a grin and the whole shouldn't.
Yeah, and Roger, but I remember, I don't know, it was 58, the 59th home run he hit in Detroit. I can't remember what home run it was, but it would happen in Detroit. But he hit a ball and hit the upper deck, right field, and hit the upper deck, so it's a home run, and it dropped down.
Yeah.
Kaline got the ball, put it in his pocket. And when he ran in, he threw the ball over to Maris. And Maris took the bat boy and took it inside, and I was locking right next, close to Roger, and I heard the question, the sports writer. He said, Roger, what did you think about Kaline coming in and giving that ball? And here was Roger's response. I thought it was nice, but I'd done the same thing for him if it was his. You know, and then they beat him to death in the newspapers the next day.
Did he realize the scrutiny he was under? That had to be kind of new for him, huh?
No, he didn't, because he has never been underneath that before. See, he wasn't with a championship team. You know, he played at Cleveland, played at Kansas City, and there's no pressure on those clubs because they weren't going to win anywhere. But when he came over to New York, it's a different situation because we go on the road, your houses, ballparks are parked, packed. They're packed at home and everything.
Sure.
Roger didn't realize it. He didn't like much of that. He was a real family man. Mm-hmm. He had six kids.
Mm.
He was very devoted to his wife and everything. So he was a good family man and never did much of anything else. You know,
He
played ball. He hung around with Bob Serve. And Bob Serve was the original bitcher, complained about everything.
Right?
So that was the worst thing to happen to him. No, Bob Serve's a nice guy.
Yeah.
But he's one of those guys that just makes too many comments.
Yeah.
When he's really out of line with his comments, instead of letting, he's one of those. Let me.
You can't let anything go.
No, he's got to top everything somebody says.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And Bob Serve is a nonstop talker.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful guy. He's got 11 kids or like that. But him and Roger roomed together all the time. So, but and I don't think Roger could ever get out of that environment. He wasn't a show off type of guy. You know, like I think I remember one time he was went out to eat with several of the ball players, and some kid or something come over. And he was just joking. He signed Babe Ruth.
Oh, gee.
And then he hollered back at the kid, "Come over here, I'll sign it." He signed it right.
Yeah.
But they ripped him up in a newspaper.
Right.
But it was just a little joke with a little kid. He signed his real signature for the kid.
Yeah. So he couldn't really do sports writers sometime. They're probably your friends and your not your friends at the same time, but they almost kind of look for that type of thing sometimes,
oh,
or
yeah.
It seem that
well,
way.
Especially in New York, Boston and New York are probably two of the worst towns I know of.
Mm.
Everybody's looking for a story to outscoop the other one.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I remember after the 58 season, Dick Young, I don't know if you'll know that
sure.
name. Okay. Dick called me on the phone from New York and he said, "Bob," he says, "how would you like to have 100% raise?" I said, "Hell, I'd like to have it. I'd love to have 100% raise." Headlines in his paper next day.
Oh,
Turley demands 100% raise.
Right.
I didn't talk to Weiss. Weiss calls me on the phone and said, "What are you doing?" I said, and I told him, "So I understand now." I said, I never said I want 100% raise. He asked what I like one. I said, "What would you say, Mr. Weiss?"
He would call anybody in the world.
Yeah.
And you get the same answer.
Yeah. All over, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Did you just look at that as part of the territory then, or is it, it's got to get to you sometimes?
Growing up, you become used to it a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I'd lose a game, I would not watch the radio, read a newspaper for 24 hours. And then it's all over with you because you're old news.
Yeah.
Somebody else's pitch and do that. But if you won a game, you'd want to read them all, watch them all, do everything. You know? But New York was that way.
Yeah, if you would have been in Milwaukee, it would have been probably a different story.
A lot different story. You'd have, because the guys probably, in Milwaukee, I don't know how many newspapers they had there, but maybe
two.
So they had maybe three or four writers that were traveling. But in hell, in New York, you had a whole train full with us.
Mm.
I mean, they were, all the newspapers in Boston, all the same, they were probably, I'm going to say, at least 15 writers travel with y'all.
Oh, my, oh, my. And like you said, all trying to top each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the papers wanted that. They wanted each one to tell a different... You had guys that covered the game. You had guys that covered the star of the game. You had the guys that covered something else. And,
yeah.
You know, a whole bunch of stuff.
So some of the guys handled that a lot better than others.
Yeah, some of them took it the right way. You never like to read anything in the paper bad about you. You love to read everything that's good about it. That's a normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't play upon our personal lives as much as they do now.
Yeah.
So our personal lives were kind of quiet, and that's a blessing for doing that. So they just covered the baseball. I guess that's why we could put up with it more.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how ball players can take it today when, you know, they cover your personal life and everything else.
Well, politics and everything else, that's fair game.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, you chose it. You got the big money, and you're supposed to draw fans in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And so you got to take the good with the bad, because if you weren't that popular, you wouldn't be making that much money. Nobody would be caring about you anyway. You know?
So I guess, yeah, again, fame comes mm-hmm. with some penalties and real perks, too.
Especially when you make your money off of your popularity.
Yeah.
I mean, you hit good in baseball, but your popularity is made by sports writers and television and everything else.
So you need those calls. Nobody showed up.
Yeah.
And no writer showed up. I'm going to make sure. Oh, I got plenty of tape.
Okay.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Bob, you alluded to it earlier, this drive that you had to succeed.
Right.
Where did that all come? Because I'm guessing now that there might have, you know, there's got to be a lot of talented baseball players out there. But without, where did that, you got to have the drive too, don't you?
Oh yeah. It's not just have the ability. It's part of it, but I don't know whether the ability is the most important thing or the other one's the drive. The drive to want to win, to excel.
Yeah.
You know, I give you a story one time that I see, you know, when ball players say this is another game, just another game when you're playing the World Series, then something's wrong, because it's not. You know, and I remember sitting in an All-Star game on the bench in Baltimore, and I was with New York at that time, and Ted Williams sitting next to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm the starting pitcher that day, so I went down and take a leak and come back, and I go down and take another leak, and he looked at me. He said, "You do the same thing that I do." I said, "What's that, Ted?" He said, "I'm so damn nervous where this game starts
that
I got to go to the bathroom all the time before it gets going."
No kidding.
And
Ted,
see, that's that drive. If you don't have that, then there's nothing in life in any area. And you got to be nervous. But that doesn't, just because you're a little nervous doesn't mean you're no good.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're, it's not as scared.
No, it's not as scared.
It's almost an anxiety. Get out, you want to get out
get
there.
Get out and get it started.
It. Yeah.
And get this stuff before, over with, and let's go on with the game. And, you know, in my life, growing up as a little kid, everything I did, I wanted to win. I mean, I don't care if I play you marbles, I'd beat you. I don't care if I play you football, I'd beat you basketball. It didn't make any difference. Yeah. I just wanted to win.
Where did it come from? Was that just something that was innate?
I think it's something you just, my mother and father weren't that way. My dad was a good person, you know, and a normal job, World War II, you know, he was in the Navy, and my mother worked, but nothing to what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they might have had it, but never had a way of showing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to win, you know, and growing up, you know, having kids of your own, and my wife would say to me, and said, "Well, let them win." I said, "They got plenty of time in life to win. Let them first learn how to lose and have a drive to want to win."
Yeah. And then the other thing is when they finally beat you, they know they beat you.
Yeah, that's right, honestly.
Not daddy
let
me win.
Yeah, that's right. I remember playing cards with my grandsons, and I made a mistake playing the cards. And he looked at me and said, "You're just doing that so I can win."
They don't know you.
No. I don't do that. I don't do that with nobody.
You know, one time I was in an exercise. It was kind of interesting. I won't go through the whole thing. But I found out the difference between a real desire to beat the other person and a desire not to lose to the other person. Is that the same thing as far
about
as...
About the same thing. I don't, you know, when I say beat, I don't want to embarrass you.
Yeah.
I just want to win.
Yeah.
My desire is to win.
Not to make me lose.
No, but make me win.
Yeah, right.
See, and I didn't, you know, of course, I didn't want nobody to hit me or anything like that. You know, of course, it obviously did hit me. But, no, I just want to be part of a winning team. You know,
yeah.
It's like you're talking about stealing signs. How'd that all come about? Well, I was with the St. Louis Browns. And you couldn't be with a worse team than that. It averaged 100 losses every single year.
The Milwaukee Brewers at their time.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and I remember one day going into the clubhouse after we just got beat real bad and going up, Marty Marion was a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only about 19 years old at that time. And we went upstairs to a clubhouse in St. Louis because it was the old Sportsman's Park. And the Browns lockered up above and the Cardinals were down below. So we were going upstairs because both teams played there.
Sure.
And I walked in a clubhouse and walked in, the guys were drinking beer, snapping towels at each other, laughing, having fun. We just got our brains beat. I mean bad. I mean something like 12 or 13 more runs than we scored or something like that. And I just walked in, probably didn't know any better, but I was just disappointed. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I walked in the clubhouse into the manager's room, Marty Marion.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Marion, I said, "I don't understand. We just lost." I said, "Those guys are having a party out there." And he looked at me and he said, "Bob, let me tell you something. If you were their age and this part of the game, they were happy they got through that game and just didn't get hurt."
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
that'd be hard for you to understand it.
Well, I couldn't.
Yeah.
And then after it went on, I knew. See, there's a lot of ball players, and more of them today than I've ever seen in my life, hanging on.
Yeah, yeah.
When they shouldn't even be in the major leagues, they're hanging on just to get another year in. And go through and get
when they're paying getting $1 million or two, it's hard to fault
them.
Well,
it's hard to walk away from. I understand that, and they're just hanging on. And of course, then you look at the owner's standpoint; they want to keep somebody has a name to draw fans in. So it just bothers me to see that. And you know, and I played losing ball clubs and I played winning clubs, and I know what made the Yankees win. That's real obvious. We all had one desire to win. There was no individual. There was individual stars from a fan standpoint, mm-hmm. but on the club there was no individual stars.
Was that true on the day you walked into the Yankee clubhouse?
Yeah, same all the way down the line.
No matter who was there.
It was a tradition that just you had enough guys overlapping and winning all the time that carried on the tradition. Mickey was one of those guys, but he wasn't one of those that would do it verbally with anybody. But I seen Mickey Mantle play games he shouldn't play. Mm-hmm. I mean, he loved to play baseball so much. And a lot of guys on the club were like that. Now, we had a few oddball guys, but they don't stay around long.
Yeah.
Don't care what your ability is, but if you don't want to win, the team and your teammates don't want you around.
So you want, when you're a Yankee, you go out there, you expect to win. When you were a Brownie, you expect
to
lose.
Yeah. And so I started to tell you, so on that club losing, and then you're sitting in there, and you lose it all. We talk from time to time.
He's low profile.
Yeah, he's another one that was not into endorsements, into that stuff.
Yeah.
He knew the business, liked him, great announcer, people liked him, Kurt Gowdy loved him.
Mm-hmm.
But then he just had enough and quit. And of course he had the thing in his neck, that's why he got out of baseball.
Ah.
He quit at a young age.
Yeah, he was kind of young. Yeah. Yeah, he was my age.
He had a pinched nerve or something up in his neck, and he could go paralyzed if he didn't get
to the chair. Oh, wow. Good time to get out.
But, yeah.
You mentioned Sportsman's Park. You played there in the last year.
Last year there, 53.
Yeah.
Huh?
What do you remember about that park?
Oh, gosh, yeah. It's growing up in East St. Louis and going over there and watching, I was more of a Cardinal fan than a Browns fan, sitting in the Knothole gang and watching the Cardinals of that era, the Musials, the Terry Moore, all those guys, Stan Musials all played ball and everything in a slot. So it was quite a thrill. Then I signed right out of high school with the St. Louis Browns when I was 17. And then to come up to the major leagues and be there, you know, it was the thrill of a lifetime.
Hometown, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I was a little kid, I forget how old I was, I was 11 years old or something. We played a 3-inning game before the St. Louis Cardinals.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And they put a fence up around our ballpark.
Yeah.
You know, so the kids little and hit over the fence would be a home run. And I remember two things before I tell the rest of that story is that our coach would give us a baseball to get autographs from the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I asked for an autograph was from a guy by the name of Harry Burkeen.
Oh,
I had a baseball, I asked him to sign my ball, and he said, "I don't have a chance right now, I've got to leave." So he didn't sign my baseball for me. Now, I'll tell the rest of that game then come back about him. But anyway, we played that game and our catcher, who was 11 years old, hit the ball in left field seats in Sportsman's Park, which is 345 feet away.
Oh, my, oh, my. Tell about thrill of a lifetime.
At a gay time, when you're only 11 years old, hit a ball in the heart. But it was Hank Byers' nephew is the one that did it.
Huh.
Hank's from East St. Louis, not from East St. Louis. He played with all my uncles. And then I played with his nephew. Even though the two of us are probably, he's probably 8 or 9 years old.
Okay.
So, but anyway, when I came up to the big leagues for the first time, the pitching coach was Harry Burkeen with ball club.
I'll be
there. He was my roommate on the road at that time. And I really let him know about how I signed my baseball.
A friend of mine back in West got a story. He grew up in Brooklyn and of chasing Harry Burkeen all over into the subway to get his autograph, and he never was successful.
Yeah.
No, I guess Burkeen lost that day, so he probably wasn't too talkative.
Well, when you lose, you're not too excited about talking to anybody.
Yeah.
What can you say? I lost.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, what peculiarities of that ballpark do you remember?
Well, of course, the right field screen. And the fence was, 315 feet or something.
So it's a pitcher. You really remember that one?
I remember it very well. And wasn't a lot of foul territory. If you get a lot of foul territory, then you're going to have a better ERA because guys hit pop flies
to
catch them. And Boston, the reason they hit so much, the averages are so high because the ballpark is so close. And they get second and third shots. Foul balls when they stand.
Okay.
That's why they have, I would swear.
That's interesting.
That gives you about a 10-point better average. When you Brooklyn was another one like that. Because Brooklyn had all great hitters there all the time. Same thing, sharp fence. Now when they go to Los Angeles playing the Coliseum, different story.
Sure it was.
Big ballpark.
Yeah.
A different story.
So Yeah, and that's a good example of a major effect on a team.
Oh, yeah.
So part of it is obviously tailoring the team to the ballpark,
that's
too.
Right. Yeah, well, you remember Pittsburgh and Hank Greenberg, or Kiner, what they call
yeah.
it, Hank Greenberg.
Greenberg's Kiner. Gardens or something
Greenberg's
they call
Gardens
it.
Gardens out there, they pulled it in so you get the
ball. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's very important.
You know, you were also a pioneer, semi-pioneer in a way that you played 1 year in St. Louis and
right.
then off to Baltimore.
Right.
What was that like? I know you pitched the opening game.
Sure
you
did.
Won it.
Right, 3-1.
Full house.
Beat Virgil Trucks.
Yeah. What was that whole thing like with the fans
well, you
and
know,
with the...
There's no way I could tell you. It was really exciting because here we come from St. Louis. I mean, I remember we played a game against the Harlem Globetrotters.
Was that right?
Second and third for the basketball game. And there must have been 15,000 people in the stands. And they could stay and see our game after that. We must have had 3,000.
Oh,
and
my.
They all left.
Yeah.
So to sit there, and you never had any fans. And even on July the 4th, we could never get over 10,000 people.
Wow.
You know, and to go from a club like a town like that to go to in another town where, my gosh, they give, I won a Cadillac that year as the most valuable player, and I won a trip to Japan.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of prizes, a lot of enthusiasm,
yeah.
A lot of people come to the games and everything. And you were heroes in town. Everybody knew you. So it was really exciting. It was like the World Series all the time. Now, well, I don't know what we drew, maybe a million and a half or something.
Yeah.
Nothing in comparison to what you drew out of Dave. But it was very exciting. Now, we weren't no different. We were the same damn team.
Yeah.
We just changed uniforms. But the fans didn't know that. We were their Orioles, you know.
And now, did that change things in a clubhouse and things like that? It's got to affect you somehow.
You know, it affected you a lot, but still, if they don't have a good team.
Yeah, it doesn't improve your talent at all.
Nellie Fox told Casey Stengel one day, because Casey was hollering, and he says, and down at home, he says, hell, you ought to win. You got the horses, you know. That's true.
Yeah. Now, what was the Memorial Stadium like?
Memorial Stadium was a pitcher stadium, a lot of foul territory.
Yeah.
Lines were short, but big out in center, big in right center, your power.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my first year there, I don't know, I pitched close to three, I might have pitched 300 innings, I don't remember.
Well, I can tell you.
I only gave up 7 home runs.
You, 247 innings.
Okay. And I gave up 7 home runs.
Yeah, that's...
See, that goes back to the theory of
yeah.
the concept. You know, you're playing in a big ballpark, they're not going to beat you with home runs. Plus, you're going to keep the averages down because it's so far.
So then when you go to Fenway, what kind of, now you have to, you have to pitch
it.
Different.
Yeah, pitch a lot different in there, but I love Fenway. I just love to pitch there.
Why was that?
Two ballparks I love to pitch in, Detroit and Fenway. Mm. And the reason for it is because home plate was right against the backstop.
Oh, okay.
And when you're on the mound and you're looking at the batter, you feel like you're right on top of it. Now you get in the Yankee Stadium, you get in the other stadium, there's so much room back there. It's like they're standing out in the field and you get no depth perception.
Yeah.
But in those ballparks, my God, when you throw the ball, you think you're throwing 300 miles an hour. And I love to pitch in Fenway and I love to pitch in Detroit. That was my two favorite ballparks.
Yeah. Which were your least favorite ballparks?
Cleveland, I think I won one game my whole career in Cleveland, and it was the last game I ever pitched there.
I pitched
some of my best ball games there, but I just couldn't seem to win.
Huh.
It was another big ballpark.
Yeah.
But I didn't fear really any ballpark. It didn't make no difference, you know.
But you do have to make some adjustments depending on the...
Yeah, where you're playing. You got to pitch accordingly. Like people say in Boston, you know, you... want to pitch them away. I'm not going to pitch nobody away in Boston. I pitch you around your hands. Because if you get around fat on it, then you're going to hit it foul. And so I break your bats and everything else. I pitch you inside.
Yeah.
And a lot of the guys pitch outside and you get killed because you can hit them out anywhere in that ballpark. Except, you know, dead center is kind of tough.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the home runs that beat you in Boston. It was the line drives. It hit the fence or little fly balls that hit the fence.
It would have been outs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I don't think, and I've been hooked on baseball since 1945,
uh-huh.
so I've seen lots of games. But I don't think, you know, even guys like me know what a head game you guys play out there.
Okay. Well, it's you really do. You pitch some guy. There's some ball players that you could pitch against that didn't know what the hell they're doing. They just went up and hit the ball.
Yeah.
The old saying, literally, you know, get a good pitch and hit it. But there were a lot of guys that never were thinking along. And I say that from my point of view. I can't get inside a hitter's head.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of hitters I pitched the same way of my whole career, and they never got a hit off of me.
Hmm.
Never knew what I was pitching. I always
never figured you out.
No, never figured out, you know.
So it's, you know, I used to think, just you got a good arm, you'll be a good pitcher, but it's this thing too.
That's right.
Is a
I don't care how hard you throw. Hitters will get to you. They can get the timing back. Mm-hmm. Pitching. Unless you're just a superstar, that's different. What makes a guy from Boston such a great pitcher is not that he throws so hard and not that he has a great curveball or a great slider, a great changeup. It's the fact that he has great control.
Okay.
He has a Maddox style of control with the ability of your superstar pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he has.
Now, that was always a challenge for you. Mm-hmm. In fact, two statistics you never saw. I'll give you the better one first.
The walks, the strikeouts? Yeah.
Well, that's what this is. Of all the guys who have ever pitched in baseball, in the whole history of the game, I want to give it. And you take a look at the hits given per nine innings.
Yeah, I know that.
Do you know that?
Yeah.
12th in all time?
Yeah, I used to be six for many years.
And but then Randy Johnson and those guys come along.
Some guys come along, yeah. So it used to, what is it, 6.7 or something?
It was something like that, yeah. Really low.
Yeah, yeah, that mm-hmm. used to be for a long time. I was six in the big league.
Yeah.
Well, another thing, you know, I remember when I would go into...
I thought I had you on that one.
No, I remember the good things. But I remember going in to talk to Weiss, and I always knew what they were going to talk about, you know, so many base on balls.
Right.
And I said, well, Mr. Weiss, I thought the object was to win. I said, I win the game? She said, yeah, you did, but you walked too many. I said, okay, how many hits I give up, Mr. Weiss? And I did kind of something. I said, okay, I want to do one thing right now. I think men on base is really what you want to look at. But if you take my walks and you take my hits and add them together and tell me who you think is the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah.
He said, Bob Lemon. I knew he was going to come back. The Bob won 25 games. I said, okay, now add them together. I was 35 less people on base than he was.
Well, that, you know, what impressed is even the traditional baseball guys, you know, like guys like George Weiss, still kind of had a look at the game that was... What you know, like your objective is to minimize the other team from scoring.
That's right.
And that's what you get paid. Yeah. If you walked 15 a game and didn't allow any hits, well, I might be exaggerating a little bit.
Well, it's like the style of pitching today. Okay, you've got middle relievers, short relievers. You got basically got three guys. A guy comes in, puts out the fire. Another guy's middle reliever. Come on, you know. And I looked at it. I says, you know. Pitching is so easy if there's nobody on base. The test of a pitcher is what happens when you get people on base.
Yeah.
I was good with people on base. Real good. In fact, that's why I did reliefing with New York. You'll see me. Mm. I started and reliefing and everything.
Yeah.
I didn't walk people when I relieved.
I think you had 12 saves or something like that in your...
I didn't walk people when I relieved. I walked people when I started.
Now, what was the difference in those two situations, Bob?
Well, when you come in a situation like that, your adrenaline gets flowing, you get men on base, and you got to reach back and get it.
Okay.
When I would walk people, it was not, well, I might have walked somebody in, I don't know, I don't remember that. But when you're in that situation, the good pitchers get better. They call the old expression, blow your neck, you know. They get better when they got men on base. You have to, because that's when you really got to bear down and get out of the situation.
Yeah, with nobody on, you don't have to.
No.
But with men on base, you have to.
That's right.
And that's one of the men-boys things.
Yeah, that's right. Those, some of those guys that are good reliefers, they'd also be good starters, too.
Mm-hmm.
They get good ability. And they just take one pitch now because they're in it for a short period of time.
Yeah.
And master one pitch, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I guess they're raised from that from boys on, almost to be a closer or what have you. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the other things that when I read the Roger Kahn's book, Boys of Summer,
mm-hmm.
One line in there really struck me. He said, this isn't a book about baseball players. He said, it's a book about men who played baseball for a living.
Right.
And that kind of put a whole, because we fans see you guys as baseball players.
Yeah.
And that's all. And the guys I've interviewed, and I've interviewed a guy named Elmer Sexhauer, who lives in Cape Coral. You never heard of Elmer because he pitched to four guys in his whole major league career.
Oh.
Played with Jackie. He walked Johnny Mize with the bases loaded, and that, and then he got a bad arm.
Yeah.
And so, but regardless, every time that this is difficult, challenging for families.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you married during this whole time? And,
yeah.
And you've got six children now.
Yeah.
I understand.
Well, I've been married three times. Divorced. Wife I've been married to now, Carolyn. We've been married 21 years.
Now, what? That career you chose has got to have an effect then.
Oh, tremendously.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the time you're away from your family on the road and everything.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's nice is all your family get to come see your work.
Yeah.
So
you get to see
your
work.
But it's doubt. You know, it creates doubts because you're on the road and the wives read the newspapers and the guys are out messing around. What are you doing, you know? I mean, I'd be doing nothing.
Were you with Billy and Mickey? And
no. I was not in that style. That was not my style.
That was a whole, yeah.
That's a whole different group of guys. But, you know, it's like whatever they did, it didn't affect their baseball.
Yeah.
Because when they came on the field, they played baseball.
Yeah.
And you had other guys that, you know, just even, they were just, like Casey said one time, they're drinking milk, and this guy drinking scotch, but the guy, well, I can't remember, he is a, said a lot of expressions, but
yeah.
One of those is, guys out here drinking, I'm getting better, you're drinking milk, this guy's out here drinking, I'm getting better pictures of drunks, you know?
Yeah.
Things like that, he would come with something like that. It's hard, because you're gone for such a period of time. Those days, we would have 18-day road trips.
Oh my, yeah.
If you weren't flying, most planes would be in training.
Yeah.
And the baseball is a different system then, because every Monday we was off, majority of Thursday was off, and doubleheaders on Sunday.
Okay.
And so that's...
And we'll talk, but there is a disclaimer here, not a disclaimer, but so you don't sue us, and it says we'll be sending copies of this to Cooperstown Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to get you in the Hall of Fame, Bob. And just as Sabre reserves the right to distribute this tape to other researchers, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I got a book that's going to come out in about probably August or September.
Huh.
I'll tell you the name of it, but I'll tell you to give an idea, but don't put this in your article, okay?
Yeah, I'll turn it off here for a second. Where do I do that? I do that right. Okay.
Okay. You know, I was with Yogi over at the fantasy camp, and I went up to Yogi, make sure it turned on.
It's fine.
And I said to Yogi, Yogi, you did that commercial with that duck. I said, what, did the duck really speak? He said, I never even saw it. But he did his scenes away from the duck.
Yeah.
And I said, Yogi, you and I have known each other a long, long time. We locked together for 8 years. And I said, Yogi, I don't remember you saying all the things you're getting credit for.
Yeah.
He said, well, I said them. And I said, well, Yogi, let me tell you one. You said the one, if you're driving down a road and you see the fork, take it. I said, Yogi, that means a lot of different things. He says, it means you take the fork, either road goes to my house. I didn't even take a fork. That's how it came out.
Well, I wasn't going to ask you about all the guys you play, because, you know, everybody's done that. But I was going to ask you that. Did Yogi really say all that stuff?
Yeah, he said, and then I said, Yogi, and the other one, I can't believe you said, because I just don't remember this, Yogi.
Yeah.
And he said, the other one, he says, well, people don't go to that restaurant anymore.
Yeah.
And Yogi says, they said, well, why, Yogi? He says, it's too crowded.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
I said, you didn't say that. He said, I sure did.
Maybe he's claiming credit for stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's made some money.
He's doing real well now. That duck commercial is probably one of the top ones out right
now. Is that right?
Yeah. But he's a hell of a nice
guy. Well, he just, from what I've seen in biographies, he just seems like a nice man.
He really is. He
yeah.
Yeah, I was watching on television the other day. He was playing in the Bob Hope Celebrity Party out there. I said, well, I can't get a hold of him. I know he ain't back home now.
Yeah.
But I'll get a hold of him. We've been friends a long time ago. Yeah.
Well, you know, you play with some interesting guys. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, another one, and maybe you get asked to death about this too, that I just thought about the other day is as you know, the Roger Maris thing in 61, what they say he went through hell at the end,
first of all, people got to know Roger. Roger was always a very quiet guy. So he wasn't a flamboyant type of guy. He didn't run around.
He wasn't Mickey.
No, he wasn't Mickey Mantle. He was an entirely different, hell of a ball, one of the best ball players of everybody. Great right fielder, throw good, run good, hit good, could do it all.
Like to have him behind you.
Yeah, and he was a great part of the team, and he was a great ball player. But Roger was the type of guy that he, dry sense of humor, sometimes he would say something before, never intend to hurt anybody, but he would say something, and it would always come out the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
Some people can do that.
No, it's true. You know, Mickey could get away with a lot of that.
Because he had a grin and the whole shouldn't.
Yeah, and Roger, but yeah, I remember. I don't know, it was the 58th, the 59th home run he hit in Detroit. I can't remember what home run it was, but it happened in Detroit. But he hit a ball and hit the upper deck, right field, and hit the upper deck, so it's a home run and it dropped down.
Yeah.
Kaline got the ball, put it in his pocket, and when he ran in, he threw the ball over to Maris, and Maris took the bat boy and took it inside, and I was locking right next, close to Roger, mm-hmm. and I heard the question, the sports writer, he said, Roger, what did you think about Kaline coming in and giving that ball? And here was Roger's response. Well, I thought it was nice, but I'd done the same thing for him if it was his. You know, and then they beat him to death in the newspapers the next day.
Did he realize the scrutiny he was under? That had to be kind of new for him, huh?
No, he didn't, because he has never been underneath that before. See, he wasn't with a championship team. You know, he played at Cleveland, played at Kansas City, and there's no pressure on those clubs because they weren't going to win anywhere. But when he came over to New York, it's a different situation because we go on the road, your houses, ballparks are packed, they're packed at home and everything.
Sure.
Roger didn't realize it. He didn't like much of that. He was a real family man, because mm-hmm. I think he had six kids, and you know, he was very devoted to his wife and everything. So he was a good family man and never did much of anything else. You know, he played ball. He hung around with Bob Serve, and Bob Serve was the original bitcher. Complains about everything,
right?
So that was the worst thing to happen to him. No, Bob Serve's a nice guy.
Yeah.
But he's one of those guys that just makes too many comments.
Yeah.
When he's really out of line with his comments, instead of letting, he's one of those. Let me.
You can't let anything go.
No, he's got to top everything somebody says.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And Bob Serve is a nonstop talker.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful guy. He's got 11 kids or something like that. But him and Roger roomed together all the time. So, but and I don't think Roger could ever get out of that environment. He wasn't a show-off type of guy. You know, like I think I remember one time went out to eat with several of the ball players, and some kid or something come over, and he was just joking. He signed Babe Ruth.
Oh, gee.
And then he hollered back at the kid, "Come over here, I'll sign it." He signed it, right?
Yeah.
But they ripped him up in a newspaper.
Right.
But it was just a little joke for the little kid. He signed his real signature for the kid.
Yeah. So he couldn't really do sports writers. Your friends and your not your friends at the same time, but they almost kind of look for that type of thing sometimes, or seem that way.
Especially in New York, Boston and New York are probably two of the worst towns I know of.
Mm.
Everybody's looking for a story to outscoop the other one.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember, after the 58th season, Dick Young, I don't know if you'll know that name. Okay. Dick called me on the phone from New York, and he said, "Bob," he says, "how would you like to have 100% raise?" I said, "Hell, I'd like to have it. I'd love to have 100% raise." Headlines in his paper next day.
Oh.
Turley demands 100% raise.
Right.
I didn't talk to Weiss. Weiss calls me on the phone and said, "What are you doing?" I said, and I told him, "So I understand now." I said, I never said I want 100% raise. He asked what I like one. I said, "What would you say, Mr. Weiss?"
He would call anybody in the world.
Yeah.
And you'd get the same answer.
Yeah. All over, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Did you just look at that as part of the territory then? Or got to get to you sometimes.
Growing up, you become used to it a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I'd lose a game, I would not watch the radio, read newspapers for 24 hours. Then it's all over with you because you're old news.
Yeah.
Somebody else's pitch and do that. But if you won a game, you'd want to read them all, watch them all, do everything. You know? But New York was that way.
Yeah, if you would have been in Milwaukee, it would have been probably a different
story. A lot different story. You'd have, because the guys probably in Milwaukee, I don't know how many newspapers they had there, but maybe
two.
So they had maybe three or four writers that were traveling. But in hell, in New York, you had a whole train full with us. I mean, they were all the newspapers in Boston, all those things, they were probably, I'm going to say, at least 15 writers travel with you all the time.
Oh, my, oh, my. And like you said, all trying to top each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the papers wanted that. They wanted each one to tell a different... You had guys that covered the game. You had guys that covered the star of the game. You had the guys that covered something else. And,
yeah.
You know, a whole bunch of stuff.
So some of the guys handled that a lot better than others.
Yeah, some of them took it the right way. You never like to read anything the paper bad about you. You love to read everything that's good about it. That's a normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't play upon our personal lives as much as they do now.
Yeah.
So our personal lives were kind of quiet, and that's a blessing for doing that. So they just covered the baseball. I guess that's why we could put up with it more.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how ballplayers can take it today when, you know, they cover your personal life and everything else.
Well, politics and everything else, that's fair game.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, you chose it. You got the big money, and you're supposed to draw fans in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And so you got to take the good with the bad, because if you weren't that popular, you wouldn't be making that much money. Nobody would be caring about you anyway. You
know? So I guess, yeah, again, fame comes mm-hmm. with some penalties and real perks, too.
Especially when you make your money off of your popularity.
Yeah.
I mean, you hit good in baseball, but your popularity is made by sports writers and television and everything else.
So you need those photos. Nobody showed up.
Yeah.
And no writer showed up. I'm going to make sure. Oh, I got plenty of tape.
Okay.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Bob, you alluded to it earlier, this drive that you had to succeed.
Right.
Where did that all come? Because I'm guessing now that there might have, you know, there's got to be a lot of talented baseball players out there. You got to have the drive too, don't you?
Oh yeah, it's not just have the ability. It's part of it, but I don't know whether the ability is the most important thing or the other one's the drive. The drive to want to win, to excel.
Yeah.
You know, I give you a story one time that I see. You know, when ball players say this is another game, just another game when you're playing the World Series, then something's wrong. Because it's not, you know, and I remember sitting in an All-Star game on the bench in Baltimore, and I was with New York at that time, and Ted Williams sitting next to me, and I'm the starting pitcher that day, so I went down to take a leak and come back, and I go down and take a leak, and he looked at me, and he said, "You do the same thing that I do." And I said, "What's that, Ted?" He said, "I'm so damn nervous where this game starts that I got to go to the bathroom all the time before it gets going."
No kidding.
And
Ted,
see, that's that drive. If you don't have that, then there's nothing in life in any area. And that little, you got to be nervous. But that doesn't, just because you're a little nervous doesn't mean you're no good.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're, it's not as scared.
No, it's not as scared.
It's almost an anxiety. Get out, you want to get out there.
Get out and get it started.
Yeah.
Get this stuff before, over with, and let's go on with the game.
Hmm.
And, you know, in my life, growing up as a little kid, everything I did, I wanted to win. I mean, I just want, I don't care if I play you marbles, I'd beat you. I don't care if I play you football, I'd beat you basketball. It didn't make any difference. Yeah. I just wanted to win.
Where did it come from? Was that just something that was innate?
I think it's something you just, my mother and father weren't that way. My dad was a good person, you know, in a normal job, World War II, you know, he was in the Navy, and my mother worked, but nothing to what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they might have had it, but never had a way of showing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to win, you know, and growing up, you know, having kids of your own, and my wife would say to me, and says, "Well, let them win." I said, "They got plenty of time in life to win. Let them first learn how to lose and have a drive to want to win."
Yeah. And then the other thing is when they finally beat you, they know they beat you.
Yeah, that's right, honestly.
Not daddy
let
me win.
Yeah, that's right. I remember playing cards with my grandsons, and I made a mistake playing the cards. He looked at me and said, "You're just doing that so I can win."
They don't know you.
No, I don't do that. I don't do that with nobody. No.
You know, one time I was in an exercise. It was kind of interesting. I won't go through the whole thing. But I found out the difference between a real desire to beat the other person and a desire not to lose to the other person. Is that the same thing as far
about
as...
About the same thing. I don't, you know, when I say beat, I don't want to embarrass you.
Yeah.
I just want to win.
Yeah.
My desire is to win.
Not to make me lose.
No, but make me win.
Right.
See, and I didn't, you know, of course, I didn't want nobody to hit me or anything like that. You know, of course, it obviously did hit me. But, no, I just want to be part of a winning team. You know,
yeah.
It's like you were talking about stealing signs. How'd that all come about? Well, I was with the St. Louis Browns, and you couldn't be with a worse team than that. They'd average 100 losses every
yeah.
single year.
The Milwaukee Brewers at their time.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and I remember one day going into the clubhouse after we just got beat real bad and going up. Marty Marion was a manager,
mm-hmm.
and I was only about 19 years old at that time. And we went upstairs to a clubhouse in St. Louis because it was the old Sportsman's Park, and the Browns lockered up above and the Cardinals were down below. So we're going upstairs because both teams played there.
Sure.
And I walked in a clubhouse and walked in. The guys are drinking beer, snapping towels at each other, laughing, having fun. We just got our brains beat. I mean, bad. I mean, something like 12 or 13 more runs than we scored or something like that. And I just walked in. Probably didn't know any better, but I was just disappointed. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I walked in the clubhouse into the manager's room, Marty Marion.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Marion, I said, I don't understand. We just lost. I said, those guys are having a party out there. And he looked at me and he said, Bob, let me tell you something. If you were their age and this part of the game, they were happy they got through that game and just didn't get hurt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
that'd be hard for you to understand it.
Well, I couldn't.
Yeah.
And then after it went on, I knew. See, there's a lot of ball players, and there's more of them today than I've ever seen in my life, hanging on.
Yeah, yeah.
When they shouldn't even be in the major leagues, they're hanging on just to get another year in. And go through and get
when they're paying getting $1 million or two, it's hard to fault them.
It's hard to walk away from. I understand that, and they're just hanging on. And of course, then you look at the owner's standpoint; they want to keep somebody has a name to draw fans in. So it just bothered me to see that. And you know, and I played in losing ball clubs and I played in winning clubs, and I know what made the Yankees win. That's real obvious. We all had one desire to win. There was no individual. There was individual stars from a fan standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But on the club, there was no individual stars.
Was that true on the day you walked into the Yankee clubhouse?
Same all the way down the line.
No matter who was there.
It was a tradition that just, you had enough guys overlapping and winning all the time that carried on the tradition. Mickey was one of those guys, but he wasn't one of those who would do it verbally with anybody. But I seen Mickey Mantle play games he shouldn't play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he loved to play baseball so much. And a lot of guys on the club were like that. Now, we had a few oddball guys, but they don't stay around long.
Yeah.
Don't care what your ability is, but if you don't want to win, your teammates don't want you around.
So you want, when you're a Yankee, you go out there, you expect to win. When
That's
you were
right.
a Brownie, you expect
to
lose. Yeah.
And so I started to tell you, so on that club losing, and then you're sitting in there, you lose it all.
He's not. He's low profile.
Yeah, he's another one that was not into endorsements, into that stuff.
Yeah,
he knew the business, liked him, great announcer, people liked him. Kurt Gowdy loved him.
Mm-hmm.
But then he just had enough and quit. And of course, he had the thing in his neck. That's why he got out of baseball.
Ah.
He quit at a young age.
Yeah, he was kind of young.
Yeah,
he was my age.
He had a pinched nerve or something. Up in his neck, and he could go paralyzed if he didn't get.
Oh wow! Good time to get out.
So yeah.
You know, you mentioned Sportsman's Park. You played there in the last year.
Last year there, 53.
Yeah.
Huh?
What do you remember about that park?
Oh gosh, yeah. It's growing up in East St. Louis and going over there and watching. I was more of a Cardinal fan than a Browns fan, but and watch sitting in the whole gang and watching. The Cardinals of that era, the Musials, the Terry Moore, all those guys, Stan Musials all play ball and everything in a slot. So it was quite a thrill. Then I signed right out of high school with the St. Louis Browns when I was 17. And then to come up to the major leagues and be there, you know, it was the thrill of a lifetime.
Hometown,
I remember when I was a little kid, I forget how old I was, I was 11 years old or something. We played a 3-inning game before the St. Louis Cardinals.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And they put a fence up around our ballpark.
Yeah.
You know, so the kids little and hit over the fence would be a home run. And I remember two things before I tell the rest of that story is that our coach would give us a baseball to get autographs from the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I asked for an autograph was from a guy by the name of Harry Burkeen.
Oh,
I had a baseball, I asked him to sign my ball, and he said, I don't have a chance right now, I've got to leave. So he didn't sign my baseball card. Now, I'll tell the rest of that game and come back about him. But anyway, we played that game, and our catcher, who was 11 years old, hit the ball in left field seats in Sportsman's Park,
yes,
which
is
345
right.
feet away.
Oh, my, oh, my. It's talk about thrill of a lifetime.
At a gate time, you know, when you're 11 years old, hit a ball that hard. But it was Hank Byer's nephew is the one that did it. Hank's from East St. Louis, I'm from East St. Louis. He played with all my uncles, and then I played with his nephew. Even though we're, the two of us are probably, he's probably 8 or 9 years old.
Okay.
So. But anyway, when I came up to the big leagues for the first time, the pitching coach was Harry Rakeem of Ball Club.
I'll be darned.
He was my roommate on the road at that time, and I really let him know if I had signed my baseball.
A friend of mine back in West got a story. He grew up in Brooklyn and of chasing Harry Burkine all over into the subway to get his autograph, and he never was
signed,
successful.
Yeah.
No, I guess Burkine lost that day, so he probably wasn't too talkative.
Well, no, when you lose, you're not too excited about talking to anybody.
Yeah.
What can you say? I lost.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, what peculiarities of that ballpark do you remember?
Well, of course, the right field screen. And the fence was, what, 315 feet or something.
So it's a picture. You really remember that one?
I remember it very well. And it wasn't a lot of foul territory. If you get a lot of foul territory, then you're going to have a better ERA because guys hit pop flies
sure.
to catch them. And in Boston, the reason they hit so much, the averages are so high because the ballpark is so close. And they get second and third shots.
Yeah.
The foul ball's going
yeah.
to stand.
Okay.
That's why they have, I would swear.
That's interesting.
That
yeah.
gives you about a 10-point better average. When
mm-hmm.
Brooklyn was another one like that. Because Brooklyn had all great hitters there all the time. Same thing. Sharp fence. Now, when they go to Los Angeles playing the Coliseum, different story.
Sure it was.
Big ballpark.
Yeah.
It's a different story.
So, yeah, and that's a good example of a major effect on a team.
Oh, yeah.
So part of it is obviously tailoring the team to the ballpark,
that's
too.
Right. Yeah, well, you remember Pittsburgh and Hank Greenberg, or Kiner, what they call
yeah.
it, Hank Greenberg.
Greenberg's Gardens or something
Greenberg's
they call
Gardens
it.
Gardens out there, they pulled it in so he could hit a lot of runs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's very important.
You know, you were also a pioneer, semi-pioneer in a way that you played 1 year in St. Louis and
right.
then off to Baltimore.
Right.
What was that like? I know you pitched the opening game.
Sure
you
did.
Won it.
Right, 3-1.
Full house.
Beat Virgil Trubbs.
Yeah. What was that whole thing like with the fans
well,
and
know,
with the...
It's the way I can tell you. It was really exciting because here we come from St. Louis. I mean, I remember we played a game against the Harlem Globetrotters.
Second
and third for the basketball game. And there must have been 15,000 people in the stands. And they could stay and see our game after that. We must have had 3,000.
Oh,
that was
my.
Where we all left.
Yeah.
So to sit there and you never had any fans, and even on July the 4th, we can never get over 10,000 people.
Wow.
You know, and to go from a club like a town like that to go to in another town where, my gosh, they give, I won a Cadillac that year as the most valuable player, and I won a trip to Japan.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of prizes, a lot of enthusiasm,
yeah.
a lot of people come to the games and everything, and you were heroes in town. Everybody knew you. So it was really exciting. It was like the World Series all the time. Now, well, I don't know what we drew, maybe 1.5 million or something.
Yeah.
Nothing in comparison to what you drew out of Dave. But it was very exciting. Now, we weren't no different. We were the same damn team.
Yeah.
We just changed uniforms. But the fans didn't know that. We were their Orioles, you know.
And now, did that change things in a clubhouse and things like that? It's got to affect you somehow.
You know, it affected you a lot, but still, they don't have a good team.
Yeah, yeah. Doesn't improve your talent at all.
Nellie Fox told Casey Stinger one day, because Casey was hollering, and he says, and down the hall, he says, hell, you ought to win, you got the horses, you know. This is true.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what was Memorial Stadium like?
Memorial Stadium was a pitcher stadium, a lot of foul territory.
Yeah.
Lines were short. But big out in center, big in right center, you power.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my first year there, I don't know, pitched close to three. I might have pitched 300 innings. I don't remember.
Well, I can
know
tell you.
I know I only gave up 7 home runs.
You, 247 innings.
Okay. And I gave up 7 home runs.
Yeah. That's.
See, that goes back to the theory
yeah.
of the concept. You know, you're playing in a big ballpark, they're not going to beat you with home runs. Plus, you're going to have... keep the averages down because the so far.
So then when you go to Fenway, what kind of, now you have to pitch different.
Yeah, pitch a lot different in there, but I love Fenway. I just love to pitch there.
Why was that?
Two ballparks I love to pitch in, Detroit and Fenway. Hmm. And the reason for it is because home plate was right against the backstop.
Oh, okay.
And when you're on the mound and you're looking at the batter, you feel like you're on right on top of it. Now you get in the Yankee Stadium, you get in the other stadium, there's so much room back there. It's like they're standing out in the field and you get no depth perception.
Yeah.
But in those ballparks, my God, when you throw the ball, you think you're throwing 300 miles an hour. And it was, I love to pitch in Fenway and I love to pitch in Detroit. That was my two favorite ballparks.
Yeah. Which were your least favorite ballparks?
Well, Cleveland, I think I won one game my whole career in Cleveland. And it was the last game I ever pitched there. I pitched some of my best ball games there, but I just couldn't seem to win.
Huh.
It was another big ballpark.
Yeah.
But I didn't fear really any ballpark. It didn't make no difference.
But you do have to make some adjustments depending on the.
Yeah, where you're playing, you got to pitch accordingly. Like people say in Boston, you know, you want to pitch them away. I'm not going to pitch nobody away in Boston. I pitch you around your hands, because if you get around fat on it, then you're going to hit it foul. And so I break your bats and everything else. I pitch you inside.
Yeah.
And a lot of the guys pitch outside and you get killed, because you can hit them out anywhere in that ballpark, except dead centers, kind of tough.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the home runs that beat you in Boston. It was the line drives that hit the fence, or little fly balls that hit the fence.
They would have been outs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I've been hooked on baseball since 1945, uh-huh. So I've seen lots of games. But I don't think, even guys like me know what a head game you guys play out there.
Yeah. Well, it's you really do. You pitch some guy. There's some ball players that you could pitch against that didn't know what the hell they're doing. They just went up and hit the ball.
Yeah.
The old saying, literally, get a good pitch and hit it. But there were a lot of guys that never were thinking along. And I say that from my point of view. I can't get inside a hitter's head.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of hitters I pitched the same way of my whole career, and they never got a hit off me.
Hmm.
Never knew how I was pitching.
Figured you out.
No, never figured out,
So it's, I used to think, you got a good arm, you'll be a good pitcher, but it's this thing too.
That's right.
I don't care
how hard you throw. Hitters will get to you. They can get the timing back pitching. Unless you're just a superstar, that's different. What makes a guy from Boston such a great pitcher is not that he throws so hard, and not that he has a great curveball, a great slider, a great changeup. It's the fact that he has great control.
Okay.
He has a Maddox style of control with the ability of your superstar pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he has.
Now, that was always a challenge for you. Mm-hmm. In fact, two statistics you never saw. I'll give you the better one first.
The walks, the strikeouts, yeah.
Well, that's what this is. Of all the guys who have ever pitched in baseball, in the whole history of the game, I want to give you. And you take a look at the hits given per nine innings.
Yeah, I know
that. Do you know that? Yeah. 12th in all time?
Yeah, I used to be sixth for many years.
But then Randy Johnson and those guys come along.
Some guys come along, yeah. So it used to, 6.7 or something?
It was something like that, really low.
Yeah, that used to be for a long time. I was sixth in the big league.
Yeah.
Well, another thing, I remember when I would go into...
I thought I had you on that one.
No, I remember the good things. But I remember going in to talk to Weiss, and I always knew what they were going to talk about, so many base on balls.
Right.
And I said, well, Mr. Weiss, I thought the object was to win. I said, I win games? He said, yeah, you did, but you walked too many. I said, okay, how many hits I give up, Mr. Weiss? And I did kind of something. I said, okay, I want to do one thing right now. I think men on base is really what you want to look at. But if you take my walks and you take my hits and add them together and tell me who you think is the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah.
He said, Bob Lemon. I knew he was going to come back. But Bob won 25 games. I said, okay, now add them together. I was 35 less people on base than he was.
Well, what impressed is even the traditional baseball guys, like George Weiss, still kind of had a look at the game that was... your objective is to minimize the other team from scoring.
That's right.
And that's what you get paid.
Yeah. That's
if you walked 15 a game and didn't allow any hits, I might be exaggerating a little bit.
Well, it's like the style of pitching today. Okay, you've got middle relievers, short relievers. You got basically you got three guys, a guy comes in, puts out the fire, another guy's middle reliever, come on. You know, and I looked at it, I says, you know, pitching is so easy if there's nobody on base. The test of a pitcher is what happens when you get people on base.
Yeah.
I was good with people on base, real good. In fact, that's why I did reliefing with New York. You'll see me. I started and reliefing and everything.
Yeah.
I didn't walk people when I relieved.
I think you had 12 saves or something like that in your...
I didn't walk people when I relieved. I walked people when I started.
Now, what was the difference in those two situations, Bob?
Well, when you come in a situation like that, your adrenaline gets flowing, you get men on base, and you got to reach back and get it.
Okay.
When I would walk people, it was not... Well, I might have walked somebody in. I don't know. I don't remember that. But when you're in that situation, the good pitchers get better. They call it the old expression, blow your neck, you know. They get better when they got men on base. You have to, because that's when you really got to bear down and get out of the situation.
Yeah, with nobody on, you don't have to.
No.
But with men on base, you have to.
That's right.
And that's one of the men boys things.
Yeah, that's right. Those, some of those guys that are good reliefers, they'd also be good starters, too.
Mm-hmm.
They get good ability. And they just... take one pitch now because they're in it for a short period of time.
Yeah.
And master one pitch, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. And they're, I guess they're raised from that from boys on almost to be a closer or what have you. You know, one of the other things that when I read the Roger Kahn's book, Boys of Summer, one line in there really struck me. He said, this isn't a book about baseball players. He said, it's a book about men who played baseball for a living.
Right.
And that kind of put a whole, because we fans see you guys as baseball players.
Yeah.
And that's all. And the guys I've interviewed, and I've been interviewed a guy named Elmer Sexhauer, who lives in Cape Coral. You never heard of Elmer because he pitched to four guys in his whole major league career. Played with Jackie. He walked Johnny Mize with the bases loaded. And, then he got a bad arm.
Yeah.
And so, but regardless, every time that this is difficult, challenging for families.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you married during this whole time? And, and you've got six children now,
yeah.
I understand.
Well, I've been married three times, divorced. Mm-hmm. Well, divorced wife. Wife I've been married to now, Carolyn. We've been married 21 years.
Now, what that career you chose has got to have an effect then.
Well, tremendously.
Yeah.
You know, and it's... the times you're away from your family on the road and everything, one of the things that's nice is all your family get to come see your work.
You get to see your work.
But it's doubt. You know, it creates doubts because you're on the road and the wives read the newspapers and the guys are out messing around. What are you doing, you know? I mean, I'd be doing nothing.
Were you with Billy and Mickey? And
no. I was not in that style. That was not my style.
That was a whole,
That's a whole different group of guys. But, you know, it's like whatever they did, it didn't affect their baseball.
Yeah.
Because when they came on the field, they played baseball.
Yeah.
And you had other guys that, you know, just even, they were just, like Casey said one time, they're drinking milk, and this guy drinking scotch, but the guy, he has said a lot of expressions, but one of them was, guy's out here drinking, I'm getting better, you're drinking milk, this guy's out here drinking, I'm getting better pictures of drunks. You know?
Yeah.
Things like that. He'd come with something like that. It's hard. It's hard on them because you're gone for a certain period of time. Those days, we would have 18-day road trips.
Oh, my.
If you weren't flying, most planes would be in trains.
Yeah.
And the baseball is a different system then because every Monday we was off, majority of Thursday was off, and doubleheaders on Sunday.
Okay.
And so that's...
And we'll talk, but there is a disclaimer here, not a disclaimer, but so you don't sue us. And it says we'll be sending copies of this to Cooperstown Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to get you in the Hall of Fame, Bob. And just as Sabre reserves the right to distribute this tape to other researchers, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I got a book that's going to come out in about probably August or September.
Huh.
I'll tell you the name of it, but I'll tell you to give an idea, but don't put this in your article, okay?
Yeah, I'll turn it off here for a second. Where do I do that? I do that right. Okay.
Okay. You know, I was with Yogi over at the fantasy camp, and I went up to Yogi, make sure it turned on.
It's working.
And I said to Yogi, I said, Yogi, you did that commercial with that duck. I said, what, did the duck really speak? He said, oh, I never even saw it. No. But he did his scenes away from the duck.
Yeah.
And I said, Yogi, you and I have known each other a long, long time. We locked together for 8 years. And I said, but Yogi, I don't remember you saying all the things you're getting credit for.
Yeah.
He said, well, I said them. And I said, well, Yogi, let me tell you one. You said the one, if you're driving down a road and you see the fork, take it. I said, Yogi, that means a lot of different things. He says, it means you take the fork, either road goes to my house. I didn't even take a fork. That's how it came out.
Well, I told you I wasn't going to ask you about all the guys you play, because, you know, everybody's done that. But I was going to ask you that. Did Yogi really say all that stuff?
Yeah, he said, and then I said, Yogi, and the other one, I can't believe you said, because I just don't remember this, Yogi.
Yeah.
And it's the other one, he says, well, people don't go to that restaurant anymore.
Yeah.
And Yogi says, they said, well, why, Yogi? He says, it's too crowded.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
I said, you didn't say that. He said, I sure did.
Maybe he's claiming credit for stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's made some money.
He's doing real well now. That duck commercial is probably one of the top ones out right
now. Is that right?
Yeah. But he's a hell of a nice
guy. Well, he just, from what I've seen in biographies, he just seems like a nice man.
He really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching on television the other day. He was playing in the Bob Hope Celebrity Party out there. I said, well, I can't get a hold of him. I know he ain't back home now.
Yeah.
But I'll get a hold of him. We've been friends a long time ago. You know.
Well, you know, you play with some interesting guys. And, you know, another one, and maybe you get asked to death about this too, that I just thought about the other day is you know, the Roger Maris thing in 61, what they say he went through hell at the end.
First of all, people got to know Roger. Roger was always a very quiet guy. He wasn't a flamboyant type of guy. He didn't run around.
He wasn't Mickey.
No, he wasn't Mickey Mantle. He was an entirely different, hell of a ball, one of the best ball players of everybody. Great right fielder, throw good, run good, hit good, could do it all.
To have him behind you.
Yeah, and he was a great part of the team, and he was a great ball player. But Roger was the type of guy that dry sense of humor. Sometimes he would say something before, never intend to hurt anybody, but he would say something, and it would always come out the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember.
Some people can do that.
No, it's true. You know, Mickey could get away with a lot of that.
Because he had a grin and the whole shooting.
Yeah, and Roger, but, you know, I remember, I don't know, it was a 58th or 59th home run he hit in Detroit. I can't remember what home run it was, but it would happen in Detroit. But he hit a ball and hit the upper deck, right field, and hit the upper deck, so it's a home run, and it dropped down.
Yeah.
Kaline got the ball, put it in his pocket. And when he ran in, he threw the ball over to Maris. And Maris took the bat boy and took it inside, and I was locking right next, close to Roger, and I heard the question, the sports writer. He said, Roger, what did you think about Kaline coming in and giving that ball? And here was Roger's response. I thought it was nice, but I'd done the same thing for him if it was his. You know, and then they beat him to death in the newspapers the next day.
Did he realize the scrutiny he was under? That had to be kind of new for him, huh?
No, he didn't, because he has never been underneath that before. See, he wasn't with a championship team. You know, he played at Cleveland, played at Kansas City, and there's no pressure on those clubs because they weren't going to win anywhere. But when he came over to New York, it's a different situation because we go on the road, your houses, ballparks are packed, they're packed at home and everything.
Sure.
Roger didn't realize it. He didn't like much of that. He was a real family man. He had six kids.
Mm.
And you know, he was very devoted to his wife and everything. So he was a good family man and never did much of anything else. You know, He played ball. He hung around with Bob Serve. And Bob Serve was the original bitcher, complains about everything.
Right?
So that was the worst thing to happen to him. No, Bob Serve's a nice guy.
Yeah.
But he's one of those guys that just makes too many comments.
Yeah.
When he's really out of line with his comments, instead of letting, he's one of those. Let me.
You can't let anything go.
No, he's got to top everything somebody says.
Oh, okay.
And Bob served as a nonstop talker. Yeah. He's a wonderful guy. He's got 11 kids or something like that. But him and Roger roomed together all the time. So, but and I don't think Roger could ever get out of that environment. He wasn't a show-off type of guy. You know, like I think I remember one time went out to eat with several of the ball players, and some kid or something come over. And he would just joke, and he signed Babe Ruth.
Oh, gee.
And then he hollered back at the kid, "Come over here, I'll sign it." They signed it already.
Yeah.
But they ripped him up in a newspaper.
Right.
But it was just a little joke for the little kid. He signed his real signature for the kid.
Yeah. So he couldn't really... Do sports writers sometime... Your friends and your not your friends at the same time, but they almost kind of look for that type of thing sometimes, seem that way.
Especially in New York, Boston and New York are probably two of the worst towns I know of.
Mm.
Everybody's looking for a story to outscoop the other one.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember, after the 58th season, Dick Young, I don't know if you'll know that name. Okay. Dick called me on the phone from New York, and he said, "Bob," he says, "how would you like to have 100% raise?" I said, "Hell, I'd like to have it. I'd love to have 100% raise." Headlines in his paper next day.
Oh.
Turley demands 100% raise.
Right.
I didn't talk to Weiss. Weiss calls me on the phone and says, "What are you doing?" I said, and I told him, "So I understand now." I said, I never said I want 100% raise. He asked what I like one. I said, "What would you say, Mr. Weiss?"
He would call anybody in the world.
Yeah.
And you'd get the same answer.
Yeah. All over, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Did you just look at that as part of the territory then, or is it got to get to you sometimes?
Growing up, you become used to it a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I'd lose a game, I would not watch a radio, read a newspaper for 24 hours. Then it's all over with you because you're old news.
Yeah.
Somebody else's pitch and do that. But if you won a game, you'd want to read them all, watch them all, do everything. You know? But New York was that way.
Yeah, if you would have been in Milwaukee, it would have been probably a different story.
A lot different story. You'd have, because the guys probably, in Milwaukee, I don't know how many newspapers they had there, but maybe
two.
So they had maybe three or four writers that were traveling. But in hell, in New York, you had a whole train full with us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were, all the newspapers in Boston, all those things, they were probably, I'm going to say, at least 15 writers traveled with you all the time.
Oh, my, oh, my. And like you said, all trying to top each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the papers wanted that. They wanted each one to tell a different... You had guys that covered the game. You had guys that covered the star of the game. You had the guys that covered something else. And, you know, a whole bunch of stuff.
So some of the guys handled that a lot better than others.
Yeah, some of them took it the right way. You never like to read anything the paper bad about you. You love to read everything that's good about it. That's a normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't play upon our personal lives as much as they do now.
Yeah.
So our personal lives were kind of quiet, and that's a blessing for doing that. So they just covered the baseball. I guess that's why we could put up with it more.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how ballplayers can take it today when, you know, they cover your personal life and everything else.
Well, politics and everything else, that's fair game.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, you chose it. You got the big money, and you're supposed to draw fans in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And so you got to take the good with the bad, because if you weren't that popular, you wouldn't be making that much money. Nobody would be caring about you anyway. You know?
So I guess, again, fame comes with some penalties and real perks, too.
Especially when you make your money off of your popularity.
Yeah.
I mean, you hit good in baseball, but your popularity is made by sports writers and television and everything else.
So you need those calls. Nobody showed up.
Yeah.
And no writer showed up. I'm going to make sure. Oh, I got plenty of tape.
Okay.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Bob, you alluded to it earlier, this drive that you had to succeed.
Right.
Where did that all come? Because I'm guessing now that there might have, you know, there's got to be a lot of talented baseball players out there. You got to have the drive too, don't you?
Oh yeah, it's not just have the ability. It's part of it, but I don't know whether the ability is the most important thing or the other one, the drive. The drive to want to win, to excel.
Yeah.
You know, I give you a story one time that I see. You know, when ball players say this is another game, just another game when you're playing the World Series, then something's wrong. Because it's not, you know. And I remember sitting in an All-Star game on the bench in Baltimore, and I was with New York at that time, and Ted Williams sitting next to me. And I'm the starting pitcher that day, so I went down to take a leak and come back, and I go down to take another leak, and he looked at me, He said, you do the same thing that I do. I said, what's that, Ted? He said, I'm so damn nervous where this game starts.
That's right.
That I got to go to the bathroom all the time before it gets going.
No kidding.
And so that's that drive. If you don't have that, then there's nothing in life in any area. And you got to be nervous. But that doesn't, just because you're a little nervous doesn't mean you're no good.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're, it's not a scared.
No, it's not.
It's almost an anxiety. Get out, you want to get out there.
Get out and get
and
it started.
It.
Yeah, get this stuff before, over with, and let's go on with the game. And you know, in my life, growing up as a little kid, everything I did, I wanted to win. I mean, I don't care if I play you marbles, I'd beat you. I don't care if I play you football, I'd beat you basketball. It didn't make any difference. Yeah. I just wanted to win.
Where did it come from? Was that just something that was innate?
I think it's something my mother and father weren't that way. My dad was a good person, you know, and a normal job, World War II, you know, he was in the Navy, and my mother worked, but nothing to what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they might have had it, but never had a way of showing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to win, you know, and growing up, you know, having kids of your own, and my wife would say to me, I said, well, let them win. I said, they got plenty of time in life to win. Let them first learn how to lose and have a drive to want to win.
Yeah. And then the other thing is when they finally beat you, they know they beat you.
Yeah, that's right, honestly.
Not daddy let me win.
Yeah, that's right. I remember playing cards with my grandsons, and I made a mistake playing the cards. And he looked at me and said, you're just doing that so I can win.
They don't know you.
No. I don't do that. I don't do that with nobody.
You know, one time I was in an exercise. It was kind of interesting. I won't go through the whole thing. But I found out the difference between a real desire to beat the other person and a desire not to lose to the other person. Is that the same thing as far
about
as...
About the same thing. I don't, you know, when I say beat, I don't want to embarrass you.
Yeah.
I just want to win.
Yeah.
My desire is to win.
Not to make me lose.
No, but make me win.
Yeah, right.
See, and I didn't, you know, of course, I didn't want nobody to hit me or anything like that. You know, of course, obviously they did hit me. But, no, I just want to be part of a winning team. You know,
yeah.
It's like you're talking about stealing signs. How'd that all come about? Well, I was with the St. Louis Browns. And you couldn't be with a worse team than that. It averaged 100 losses every single year.
The Milwaukee Brewers at their time.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and I remember one day going into the clubhouse after we just got beat real bad and going up. Marty Marion was a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only about 19 years old at that time. And we went upstairs to a clubhouse in St. Louis because it was the old Sportsman's Park. And the Browns lockered up above and the Cardinals were down below. So we're going upstairs because both teams played there.
Sure.
And I walked in a clubhouse and walked in, the guys were drinking beer, snapping towels at each other, laughing, having fun. We just got our brains beat. I mean bad. I mean something like 12 or 13 more runs than we scored or something like that. And I just walked.